on the field, inside the clubhouse, and everything in between. This is Brewers Weekly. Here's Dominic Catronio.
Hey, everybody. Once again, off-season edition of Brewers Weekly. I'm Dominic Catronio. Let's get things going. Now it's time for the stove to click on and get ready for all the moves that are going to happen this offseason. We'll talk about these next 5 days, what it all means for Major League Baseball, what to expect over these next 5 days, including a couple of trades that have already happened today as I'm recording this on Halloween night on Thursday. If you're listening to this tonight or even Friday morning, there could have already been more moves by the time I recorded this, but we'll talk about Monday's deadline and what that means. We'll talk about the World Series a little bit. You know, by now, maybe you've heard all of the takes that needs to be said about, you know, the Yankees forgetting how to play defense for an inning and the Dodgers, you know, coming from behind and setting the Moneyball music to every single highlight for a team that spent over $1 billion in this past offseason. But we'll talk about them a little bit later on. We'll talk about award season on the horizon, the Gold Glove nominees. We'll talk about Pat Murphy's candidacy. We'll talk about Jackson Chourio's candidacy. But we're going to begin today with the big news that came out earlier this week on Tuesday, that Chris Hook is indeed returning to the Milwaukee Brewers as their pitching coach for 2025 and beyond, a multi-year extension. No details further beyond that from the Brewers. And we talked to Chris Hook on Tuesday after it was announced, and it was a very clear from my sense of things that this was never really seriously negotiated anywhere else. Like, Chris Hook always felt like he was going to be coming home. The Brewers made sure of it. In fact, conversations actually began in the final week of the regular season. And there was synergy all around with Chris Hook, Matt Arnold, general manager, owner Mark Adonasio, and also by manager Pat Murphy. We talked about it in last week's episode with the hitting coach movement that Ozzie Timmons is not returning to the Brewers, but Connor Dawson is returning. Al LaBeouf and Eric Tyson have been promoted to the big league staff. So there is still some question marks in this coaching staff. And one of the main cogs that makes the Brewers successful is Chris Hook. No matter how much he wants to deflect and give credit to other people, he is a massive reason for the Brewers' success to this point and all the value they've got out of their pitching staff and being able to continue to extract value out of players that other teams feel are not valuable anymore. I mean, this year, the examples write themselves. What he did with Tobias Myers this year, for him to become a middle-of-the-rotation type guy on his sixth organization after having 15, 16 losses, whatever it was, just 2 years ago in AA. I mean, it's an incredible development story there. Or what they were able to unlock out of Aaron Civale, what they were able to unlock out of Frankie Montas, and just after a couple of months being Brewers and finding edges and finding chances for them to be successful as the Brewers push to the playoffs. And furthermore, you look at what they did in the bullpen himself and Jim Henderson in this bullpen, not having Devin Williams for the first half plus of the season, developing Trevor Megill, not having Abner Uribe be on the first month of the season as well, developing guys to be successful in leverage roles, fixing Yoel Piamps, who had a rough first half, had a great second half, getting help from AAA with Aaron Ashby getting back on track, and even guys that kind of jumped up like Megill, Mears toward the end of the year as well. There are a lot of pieces in this bullpen that I'm excited that get to have the continuity with Chris Hook into the 2025 and beyond season. And the quote that he had, you know, I asked him, hey, why would you ever consider, you know, why would somebody else find this job attractive, you know, coming to Milwaukee? Why does it work so well here? And it's not just you on this. Like, why does Milwaukee have the resources to continue to develop pitching? And I thought his answer was really brilliant. And it's just, they have the systems in place that the front office can recognize something because they trust Hook, Chris, into what he can do with a player. And Hook knows that what they're giving him is a canvas that they trust him with. And then furthermore, the scouting departments know what the Brewers like and what they identify. And so it's all this sort of system that everybody's talking the same language, and it helps the Brewers develop better pitching. And it all starts at the top with Chris Hook and the resources that they have poured into the pitching department. Obviously, the pitching lab steals a lot of the headlines, but there are biomechanists that are involved on this. There are strength and conditioning. There are doctors involved on this. I mean, Brandon Woodruff missed the entire season, and the Brewers hired medical personnel to help him in his rehab in the 2024 season, so he is ready for 2025. That is part of the system and the synergy that everybody's speaking the same language, that they all want to make sure they can be as successful as possible on the pitching front. We are awaiting word on Jim Henderson. I imagine with Hook coming back, Henderson should be a candidate to return. Adam McAlvey reporting that he is still in negotiations. But with all of this being said, as good news as it is that Chris Hook is returning, there is a little bit of the other side of that coin, is there is a key departure, and not because the Brewers didn't try to keep him, and that is Quinson Berry. It is being reported by the Chicago beat corps and everyone down there on the north side that Quinton Berry is headed to the Cubs and to join Craig Counsell's staff in the 2025 season as their third base coach and to help with their base running. Of course, they departed their base coaches and Mike Napoli and Willie Harris this past offseason, and now Craig Counsell gets to use a familiar face in Q Berry, as he was a free agent. He's allowed to do so into the 2025 season. So I wish Q nothing but the best. Can't wait to see him early next season, and really enjoyed picking his brain. So the Brewers are hiring a first base coach, base running coordinator, outfield assistant as well for the Brewers into this coming season. With all that being said, I want to make one last point on Chris Hook before we move on to a different topic here. All season, especially in September, when the Brewers won the division, and then when they made it into the playoffs, and then the end of season wraps and everything like that, the common denominator of what everybody said as to why the Brewers are successful is people. And it is their development staff. It is their coaching staff. It is their front office. It is, and all of the above. This is across the board. Everybody says people. With all that being said, I think this is really putting your money where your mouth is in re-signing Chris Hook. Because if you're going to sit here and tell me, you know, hey, people is how we do this, development is how we do this, patience is how we do this, and continuity and keeping the guys that understand our system and understand our players to keep them involved is how we do things, yeah, that's a great thing and a great way to go about it. And one way that you can confirm that that's what you're really about is re-signing Chris Hook. And that's exactly what they did. So I tip my cap. They did exactly what every Brewer fan hoped they would do when it came to the Chris Hook negotiations. He is back for multiple years. He is still going to be working with a pretty similar core. When you look ahead to 2025, you figure the rotation is going to look something like this, with Brandon Woodruff and Freddie Peralta, TBD who's going to be opening day, given you got to still have a question mark on Brandon Woodruff's health. You're also going to have a debate of DL Hall and Aaron Ashby. Are they going to be built up as starters? Chris Hook confirmed as such. They will be approached to as starters at the beginning of spring training next year. So there's two more names right there. You've got a club option to decide on Colin Ray. More on that in a moment. You've also got a chance to decide what you want to do with Wade Miley, given he is having Tommy John surgery. He probably wouldn't be back until July, August, given the rehab process that it would take for him. You have to decide what you want to do with that guy. Gasser is probably not going to be a big factor in this year's rotation. But then furthermore, you've got the guys on the way, the Chad Patricks, the Hendersons, and of course the Mizorowskis that are going to be candidates this spring training. So it's an exciting canvas that Chris Hook has to play with in spring training just from a starting standpoint. And this is, you know, even before we talk about all those prospects there at the end, they've got options to choose from here in 2025. So congratulations to Chris Hook, aka Hooky. Really enjoyed our time with him here on WTMJ throughout the regular season. With all that being said, let's jump into what these next 5 days are going to be and sort of the odds and ends and the transactional period that is the offseason beginning. I touched on this briefly in last week's podcast, but let's talk about it again. These 5 days that just began today officially begins the offseason. But the reason why we say 5 days is because this window that you're in right now is exclusively for free agents to negotiate with their teams. There's a soft window right here, unrestricted free agents, if you will. Furthermore, these 5 days are when teams and players have to decide on the options of their contracts, meaning does he have a player option? Does he have a club option, or is there a mutual option? Vesting options have already been taken care of because those are based on performance and meaning innings thresholds and that sort of thing. Let's start with the club options that the Brewers have in front of them for the 2025 season. A no-brainer here, Freddy Peralta. He is in his first of back-to-back years of club option years. This year and 2026, he's still under team control. The opt-in is for $8 million. They are going to do that. The buyout's $1.5, but there's no sense in wasting any more breath. Freddy Peralta is going to be picked up for his club option. Next, Colin Ray. $5.5 million for his club option, $1 million buyout. To me, this seems like a no-brainer. This seems like re-sign. You can never have enough pitching. It would cost more on the open market to get a player of that caliber, of that familiarity, and somebody that understands your system very well. I think Colin Ray is a great fit. He doesn't need to be leaned on as the three, hopefully, next season or the two next season. He can mold into more of a 4-5 role for the 2025 season if things go according to plan. So I think they're picking up that $5.5 million club option. The last club option on here is Eric Haas. I was not able to nail down a firm dollar amount, but there is a club option for Haas to return as the backup catcher for the Brewers. Let me give you a reason why they would do it, and let me give you a reason why they wouldn't do it. First, for the reason why they would. They really like Eric Haas. They tried to keep him as hard as they could at the end of spring training, you know, waiting to the last possible moment to DFA him while other rosters were full. He spent all of spring training with the Brewers. He was a big piece in the last 2 months of the season to give William Contreras days off. He has familiarity. It's not going to be expensive. He's well-regarded in the clubhouse. I think that's a really good option to pick up as your backup catcher unless something changes between now and spring training. The reason why you wouldn't do it is if Eric Haas believes he can get a better deal on the open market, which, quite frankly, I don't know if he can. There isn't a lot on the free agency market from a backup catcher perspective, and I mean this kindly to Gary Sanchez. I don't think Gary's coming back. And Gary's got a mutual option while we're on the subject, and that's a TBD. It was based on his playing time this year, and there was an injury in there. None of that is concrete reporting as to what his mutual option becomes based on his playing time this year, but mutual options almost never get picked up, and that means he will probably be a free agent. So you've already got Eric Haas in the building, might as well keep him around. And furthermore, you've still got Jefferson Caro on the way, and this is one of the reasons why in the do not pile it's like, well, why not go to Caro? Well, this is actually a reason to put him in the do pick up Eric Haas category. Caro missed all of last year with a shoulder injury and shoulder surgery. He is going to be a full participant in spring training, however, he's still not really played above AA. He's played one game in a week of AAA baseball. And as a catcher, probably needs a little bit more seasoning in the minor leagues to get him ready. He's already on the 40-man roster. That was protected last year out of the Rule 5 draft. So you don't have to worry about that sort of thing. You will have to use his first option year, I imagine, this year coming out of spring training. So that's why I think they're going to pick up Eric Haas's club option. As for the mutual options, again, these are almost never picked up, and particularly the first one on this list, Frankie Montas. Frankie's owed $20 million if the mutual option is picked up. The Brewers don't spend $20 million on pitchers on one-year deals. That's just not how they roll. It's a $2 million buyout, so he will be a free agent with $2 million in his pocket. And it's unclear how much the Reds are paying or how much the Brewers are paying. Part of that was the Jacob Junis deal and that the Brewers were paying a lot of Jacob Junis's contract back to Cincinnati. So I imagine the Brewers are going to be totally on the hook for this buyout. Next, Wade Miley. $12 million mutual option. Again, a guy coming off Tommy John surgery. The Brewers are going to decline their end of the option. That's a $1.5 million buyout. However, I would not be surprised if he sits on free agency for a little while and then decides what he wants to do, if he wants to retire, if he wants to continue to rehab. And then finally, we mentioned Gary Sanchez. I don't think that one's getting picked up either. That leaves just one option remaining, and that is the one that has been well reported, and it seems like a no-brainer that is going to be picked up, Rhys Hoskins. He's owed $18 million as a player option. He has the full control over that deal, which means he can say in the next 5 days, he has until Monday at 4 o'clock Eastern time to say, hey, I'm going to opt in. And I imagine he is going to do so. So with that being said, of these options, I think the only drama comes with, do they re-sign Haas? I imagine Hoskins is going to opt in. They're obviously going to re-sign Peralta, and I think they, I'm 90% certain they're going to re-sign Colin Ray. So you have until Monday to decide all of that. But on the last part of this until Monday deadline is the soft negotiation period with free agents. These unrestricted free agents, only two for the Brewers, Joe Ross and Willy Adames, have exclusive bidding window with the most previous team that they've been on. Willy Adames, of course, with the Brewers. Deciding, all right, here's the number. If you meet this number, if you want to agree to this number, or if you want to wait till the open market, cool, you can. But if you wait until the open market, that number is going to go away and it's going to become a qualifying offer. The Brewers would have to give the qualifying offer, I believe, by the end of November. There's a date in November that states that they have to give the qualifying offer to until. But the fact of the matter is, it seems like a foregone conclusion. They're not going to re-sign Willie. So that's where you give him the qualifying offer, which is about $20 million this year. He's going to decline and go get a multiple-year deal. In case you're not familiar, the qualifying offer is the average of the top, I believe, 100 salaries in Major League Baseball. You get a one-year deal for a small market team. If that player signs and opts in, it's happened a couple of times over the last handful of years, that player opts in, boom, that's your one-year salary, and he can no longer be offered a qualifying offer. He becomes an unrestricted free agent for the following year. However, if that player declines the qualifying offer and goes to free agency, whatever team signs that player forfeits a draft pick, and that draft pick becomes a compensation draft pick, aka a sandwich pick, between the first and second rounds and the second and third rounds in the following year's draft. So the Brewers will receive a draft pick, I imagine, for not signing Willy Adames, if that is indeed what happens. And then Joe Ross, no qualifying offer debate here. He is likely just going to be an unrestricted free agent heading into the 2025 season. So that's your quick little immediate primer for what's to come over these next 5 days. And maybe by this time next week, we'll have more to react to as far as Brewer signings, opt-ins, and that sort of thing. With all that being said, let's turn the page. Let's talk a little bit more positive stuff of what's on the way here for the Brewers in award season, as it is upon us here soon. We don't have the dates yet from the Baseball Writers Association of America, but we know generally how it works is the first award of the offseason is the Manager of the Year award. And look, quite frankly, if Pat Murphy is not unanimous for Manager of the Year, I'm really looking forward to these columns that the writers are going to say that he does not deserve it, because this dude is Manager of the Year. And if it would be a really funny bit, it kind of be a cruel bit, but it'd be a really funny bit if it continues that no Brewer manager has ever won Manager of the Year. Yes, even all of those great council years in 2018 and everything that goes into that, he did not win Manager of the Year. Or furthermore, Harvey Keene did not win Manager of the Year in 1982, given how much reverence, and heck, he didn't even start the year with them. So it's a whole bit of things to talk about for content creators like yourself if he doesn't win. But I imagine Pat Murphy's going to win. He's already won the Sporting News National League Manager of the Year. I imagine we're going to see more of that coming forward. And another quick note on the Players' Choice Awards. This one's by the Players' Union. Rhys Hoskins also earned the Marvin Miller Man of the Year Award, which is given to the top philanthropist, which is basically, it's a great award, don't get me wrong, but it's one step below the Roberto Clemente Award. This one is only voted on by your peers. The Roberto Clemente Award has club officials involved, has executives involved, and that sort of thing. But Salvador Perez won that as the Roberto Clemente Award winner. Rhys Hoskins won the Marvin Miller Man of the Year Award for 2024. So congratulations to Rhys on that. Couple of things that we've talked about at the end of the regular season that I'm excited for into award season. Of course, National League Rookie of the Year. And what Jackson Churio finished his season with, the first ever 2020 season under the age of 21 years old. It seems like in the popular vote, it's a two-horse race between Jackson Merrill and Paul Skeens. And I'm not here to argue the merit of that. They're both very deserving candidates. But I'm really intrigued to see how many second-place votes Jackson Churio is going to steal. And I don't even want to say it like steal, but I want to say the fact that there is debate here. And I don't want to let the East Coast bias come through, where everyone on the East Coast seems to automatically assume it's going to be Paul Skeens, and everybody on the West Coast seems to automatically assume it's going to be Jackson Merrill. The folks here in the middle, they can see both sides pretty easily, and they also, hey, what about this guy? What about this Cheerio kid? So I'm intrigued to see how many second place votes he gets. I don't think it's going to be a clean sweep where he only gets third place votes. I'm really excited to see how many folks are, ready to give their reasoning as to why he's the second, or even by some cases, number one National League Rookie of the Year. So that's something we're going to monitor. And the other thing we're going to monitor is the fact that the Brewers don't really have a bona fide MVP candidate. Now, they have great players on their team, but how many down ballot votes are their candidates going to get? How many down ballot NL MVP votes are William Contreras going to get? Are Willy Adames going to get? Or even Jackson Churio going to get? Those are the things that I'm going to be looking for when it comes to the Baseball Writers Association awards. Again, those are Manager of the Year, Rookie of the Year, Cy Young, and MVP. I would listen to the fact that, hey, we should separate it like the NFL does, where you have both a conference, if you will, defensive player, defensive rookie of the year, and offensive rookie of the year, right? They're different disciplines. So I wouldn't be opposed to a National League rookie pitcher of the year. That could also open the door for some relievers to get the job more often. And I'm also not opposed to, a National League offensive rookie of the year, which would then make it a two-horse race between Churio and Merrill. So these are things that are on my mind. They're probably not on the minds of the Baseball Writers Association of America, but maybe we'll see that change one day down the road. With all that being said, I wrote this down in my notebook right when the postseason began of, all right, if I had a ballot, what would my ballot look like if I was a Baseball Writer Association? Now, I'm not doing the Manager of the Year votes because, again, I've already told you, it's Stephen Vogt and it's Pat Murphy. I don't care who finishes second and third. It's Stephen Vogt and Pat Murphy. Now, as for Cy Young, this seemed like the easiest award of the year. Number one in the American League is going to go to Tarek Skubal. And number one in the National League is going to go to Chris Sale. Then it got interesting. And a reminder, all Baseball Writer Association award voting is done before the postseason begins. All ballots are locked before the postseason. So there is nothing that happens in October that can impact a player's candidacy for a regular season award. With that being said, in the National League, the rest of my Cy Young vote went Zach Wheeler, Dylan Cease, Logan Webb, and Hunter Green. I think we need to take a deeper look at how great Hunter Green was this regular season. Now, the reason why I gave that disclaimer just a moment ago about why it's so important to remember, hey, October does not get included on this, is because of my second player in the American League Cy Young. And I put Emmanuel Clase second. Here's why. If there's ever a year for a closer to get Cy Young Award votes in the modern game, it would have been this kind of year. He became the all-time Cleveland franchise leader in saves. He had more saves than anybody else in Major League Baseball. He had a microscopic ERA and opponent batting average. He had as a dominant of a season as a closer as you could imagine. Now, obviously, that did not work against the Yankees twice in the American League Championship Series. He also gave up a homer to Kerry Carpenter. He was not the same guy in October. All that being said, his regular season accomplishments speak for themselves. In a really stinky year for the American League pitching side of things, I put Clase 2, I put Framber Valdez 3, I put Corbin Burns 4, and then finally Cole Reagans on the Royals at number 5. Now moving to the MVP voting. I'm not going to give Rookie of the Year either because I think this is tough when it comes to Skeens, Merrill, Churio. The one note I'll make on Rookie of the Year in the American League side, how is Mason Miller not getting more pub as a potential rookie of the year in the American League? It seems a foregone conclusion that it's going to go to Colton Cowser or Luis Gil. First of all, I'm not giving it to the guy that led all of baseball in walks, and that's Luis Gil. And second of all, Colton Cowser had some devastating slumps in the middle of the season this year. And I know he was great against the Brewers in April. He was really quiet after that, and he had multiple long slumps. Mason Miller set an Oakland A's record for most saves by a rookie. And that rookie, the record that he broke, Andrew Bailey, current pitching coach of the Boston Red Sox, well, he won Rookie of the Year his year. So I think it should be Mason Miller in the American League. Maybe that's my A's bias coming through, but I digress. Now for the MVP vote. This one was tough. The top two, again, are not hard at all for both leagues. Aaron Judge, American League. Shohei Ohtani, National League. No problem at all. Bobby Witt Jr., number two in the American League. This is where I zigged when everyone else, I think, is zagging. I put Ketel Marte, too. Francisco Lindor, three. Lindor had a great year. So did Ketel Marte. And they both got hurt at the end of the year, which may impact their candidacy. And I think at the end of the day, Lindor is probably going to be the second MVP in the runner-up. We need to take a deep, long look at Ketel Marte's year. Defensively, offensively, what he did for this club. I am such an admirer from afar of Ketel Marte's game, a switch-hitting second baseman that plays above-average defense, that puts bat on ball. Man, I just really found him to be a dynamic player. If you want to give the edge to stolen bases to Francisco Lindor, I completely understand that. When it comes to Ketel Marte, a little bit more pop. They're both switch hitters. I think Ketel, by the metrics, has a little bit better defensive metrics. However, I still think Francisco Lindor should have been nominated for a Gold Glove. I think the metrics are a little odd and off on Lindor. But nonetheless, that's my vote. It's hypothetical. It's all made up. Don't get mad. Third, I had Lindor. Third in the AL, I had Jose Ramirez. I thought that was a no-brainer. Gunnar Henderson, four. Marcelo Ozuna, four. Remember, you get to vote 10 players. This is what I'm talking about, the down ballot stuff. So the National League again. Ohtani, Marte, Lindor, Ozuna, William Contreras. William gets my fifth vote in the NL MVP. Then 6 through 10 goes like this. Ellie De La Cruz. Same reason I couldn't give Luis Gil the top spot in the American League Rookie of the Year. I can't give Ellie De La Cruz, who led baseball in strikeouts, above William Contreras. Ellie 6th. Jerickson Profar had an incredible year. He's 7th. Mookie Betts, if he spent the whole year healthy, we're talking about him as an MVP candidate. He's 8th. I got Jackson Merrill 9th. And then I've got both Willie Adames 10th. So I got two Brewers on my top 10. Over on the American League side, number 5, I've got Jarren Duran. 6, I've got Juan Soto. 7, Vlad Jr. 8, Yordan Alvarez. 9, Brent Rooker. Go look at that stat line again and tell me you're not impressed. And 10, kind of similar to what I talked about with Emmanuel Clase. If there's ever a time for a reliever to get, you know, Cy Young votes, it would be this year. I think this is a year for a starting pitcher to get MVP votes, and that is Tarek Skubal. I put Tarek Skubal as my 10th in MVP voting in the American League. Again, hypothetical, don't get mad. If you want to get mad, you can tweet me at Dom_Cutronio. And maybe we'll actually have an engaging dialogue on it, but we'll revisit this once the announcements are actually made. Let's begin to land a plane here. A couple quick other award notes, something we'll keep an eye on. Remember, this is Rawlings coaches award voting in the Gold Glove Awards. Bryce Terang, Blake Perkins, and Sal Frelick are all nominated for Gold Gloves. Once we have the award show reveal, we'll revisit this topic of their candidacy. Quite frankly, Bryce Terang should win it. I also think Sal Frelick should win it. I think Blake Perkins has an uphill battle. Jacob Young and Brenton Doyle are his competition. All three had fantastic seasons. Personally, I would have voted for Jacob Young. So that's a quick note on Gold Gloves. And then finally, let's give my end of year World Series thoughts. I'm not going to bag on the fifth inning too much, even though I did tweet and I'll say it again. That was the worst inning of defense I think I've ever seen from a major league team, and maybe ever. Again, I played JV freshman baseball. Okay. Like, that was bad and there's no hiding it. I mean, Judge should have caught that ball. Volpe could have made a better throw. Even if Gerrit Cole gets over to cover, I don't think that he's going to beat Mookie Betts up the line. That's on Rizzo for not charging the baseball and not trying to make it a play. And, you know, he was leaning on Cole being there the whole way. I don't think Cole had a chance. He had to throw 35 pitches. He was out of gas in the inning more than that. And then ultimately, Freddie Freeman and Teoscar Hernandez cash it in. And that's the big point I want to make here. I understand the big market stuff. We talked about it last week. But at the end of the day, man, the Dodgers played fundamental baseball. And the Brewers play fundamental baseball. And they were two outs away from moving on. And the thing that I pull away from this is that the teams that play good fundamental baseball, look how little the Dodgers struck out this postseason. One of the lowest strikeout rates all time in postseason. I mean, they talked about it plenty about how little they chase, and the Brewers are right there with them analytically when it comes to how disciplined they are as hitters, how much contact they make with two strikes. It's always been the Brewers, the Dodgers, and the Padres are the teams that are really, really good at controlling the strike zone. And Freddie Freeman's two-strike, two-out single to drive in two runs. That made it 5-3 at the time. But then Teoscar drives one, gets a mistake to deep left center field. That all began because of a two-strike, two-out hit. I know Otani struck out with one out, and they had a chance to get out of that frame. They didn't. But nonetheless, that's where the money comes in. Where after, oh, cool, I got through Otani. Oh, shoot, now I got to deal with Betts. He puts a two-strike pitch in play. Oh, now I got to deal with Freeman. He puts a two-strike pitch in play. You get what I'm trying to say. Yes, they have a lot of money to deal with, but good fundamental baseball is never going to go out of style. And quite frankly, we don't pay players for that. We pay players for the home runs. We pay players for strikeouts. We pay players for velocity, that sort of thing. We lose sight of the fundamental baseball here and there. And I thought that inning, and really the whole World Series, was a masterclass of the Dodgers just playing better fundamental baseball than the Yankees. We've talked about it plenty that the Yankees are the worst base running team in baseball. That is a statistical fact. They took the fewest amount of extra bases when they were trying to, you know, like on a first to third. Look at Volpe in game four. Look at their lack of success on the base paths in the Royals series. They even had a couple of outs on the bases against the Guardians. That's not been good. Their defense has been meh. And then Judge making his first error of the year was poorly timed, of course. But nonetheless, the team that makes the fewest mistakes generally wins. And that was really apparent. And it's really magnified when you're in the playoffs and every little thing matters. Now, if you want to say, oh, now it's not a fair fight. The Dodgers spent all that money. So you have to spend $1 billion. Is that how much a World Series costs? Look, I'm not sitting here and saying that it's easier to not spend $1 billion on an offseason to make the World Series. But nonetheless, I was one of the people, and I've said it publicly, I'll say it again. I had a really hard time with 2020 and counting 2020 as a title that is going to hold the same amount of vigor and prestige as, say, like a 1986, the last time the Dodgers won the World Series, because it was a full season. However, you know, as I sit and waffle and think about it all the time, hey, that was the first year of the expanded playoffs, so technically it was harder to win the playoffs that year. Of course, they steamrolled the Brewers, and those are some funny lineups. We want to go look back at the 2020 wildcard round. But furthermore, they did it with extenuating circumstances, with the pandemic and the bubble and having to go to Texas for the World Series. And there's a lot of oddities that were involved with all of that. So I think it's still very impressive that they were able to do what they were able to do. But still, it's, well, 60 games. A lot of things can happen in 60 games, right? And in fact, just for the sake of the exercise, I'm going to do it right now here live on Beautiful Podcasting. But just looking at, hey, what was the record this year? Or who had the best record in baseball through 60 games of this season? That puts you approximately like June 2nd or so, June 1st. Let's just go ahead and say June 1st and see how many games that gives us for the standings on that date. Most teams are right around 59 to 62 games at this point in the season. 60 games in, the Yankees would have been the number one seed in the American League. The Phillies would have been the number one seed in the National League. The Dodgers were two. The Guardians were two in the American League. So, hey, what do you know? Almost exactly like what it looked like in the National League Championship Series when it came to the Dodgers. Now, the Mets were the Mets. They were 10 games under 500, 60 games into the season. So that tells you a little bit something to keep in mind of. Over in the American League, the team that was kind of loitering around was the Tigers. They were two games under 500. They ultimately made the playoffs. And in fact, the Mariners, they were six games over 500, while the Astros are seven games under 500. So in 2020, the Astros wouldn't have even made the postseason given that 60 game. That's why I say all this to say, throw it out the window now. The Dodgers have won a full season expanded playoff title. Barring the payroll stuff, okay? If you want to complain about payroll, you've come to the wrong podcast. I'm sorry. I'm just not one of those guys. However, one of the things that payroll does, and one of the little secrets about having a big payroll, isn't just being able to shell out $325 million to a Japanese star in Yoshinobu Yamamoto, or shelling out deferred money to Shohei Ohtani. But it's being able to hire an analytics staff. It's being able to have analysts and development and people whose job it is to find every little advantage you can get. The next time you watch the Dodgers next year when they come to Milwaukee, watch how often every single pitch defenders are moving. Just two, three steps. It could change pitch to pitch. Now, Brewers do it too, but it takes a lot of man and woman power to make this happen on a big league scale. And it shouldn't be a surprise that they got the job done as successfully as they did. Furthermore, the other little secret about payroll is you're able to absorb deals and make deals because you have big payroll. I look at Manny Margot. He was cut today by the Minnesota Twins. The Dodgers paid the Rays, who traded him in the Tyler Glasnow deal, to not play for the Dodgers, and then traded him to the Twins. And again, the Dodgers paid for that, even though he was on a second team since being on the Dodgers. So that kind of payroll flexibility is certainly helpful. And it's also allowing you to take a chance on relievers and on young starters because they had so many injuries this year. But hey, boo-hoo, woe is me. Everybody has injuries at this point in the year. So all that being said, I commend the Dodgers. An incredible year. It's hard to have a target on your back all season long and deliver. And they did that. And I tip my cap. They earned it. It is going to be a fascinating offseason because for them, do they re-sign Teoscar Hernandez? Do they go after Willy Adames? Are they able to sign a lockdown closer? Do they trade for Devin Williams? There are still vacancies in that team. Do they go get a starter that can make them repeat in 2025? As for the Yankees' perspective, their team is pretty similar heading into next year, aside from the Juan Soto question. Where does Juan Soto go in free agency? Now, for the content, I would laugh if he goes to the Mets. For the sake of lineup balance and making the American League entertaining, I would love to see Soto stay with the Yankees. But there could be a mystery team. There could be rumors. I would imagine this news would break during the winter meetings as to where Juan Soto is going to go because there are only a handful of teams really in on Juan Soto. And that's the kind of something that Scott Boras would love to have the center of attention on in the winter meetings. Okay, I think that does it. I think I said everything I wanted to say. The Brewers are entering off-season mode, and by this time next week, we could have more news on who's missing, who's going, who's signed, and who are the targets for the Brewers this coming off-season. We'll also effort some interviews throughout this off-season too here on the podcast feed, and we'll also get back live on WTMJ as well once there are not Bucks conflicts. They stopped playing some Thursday games here later in November, so we'll get back on that air. I believe on the 14th is our next scheduled day on live radio on WTMJ. Well, I'm self-produced today, so my thanks to you for listening here to the podcast. Remember to tell your friends about it all off-season long. Brewers All Access. I'm Dom Cotronio. You can follow me on Twitter at Dom, D-O-M, underscore, C-O-T-R-O-N-E-O, Cotronio. Pretty easy to remember, I hope. That's going to do it for me. We'll see you next week, another recorded podcast version. And until then, keep on swinging.